So this morning we're going to get Joseph down to Egypt. It's about time, right? Poor guy. This is not. It's true. It's true. At least he's not going to Libya. Do you know, by the way, something remarkable? Not about Libya, but just about this. Do you realize that? All these nations that were created essentially by the British Empire, it's what Churchill said, you know, with a stroke of my pen, I changed the world, which is exactly what he did, and not always to the better of the world. But the amazing thing is that they were, almost all of them, throughout all, most of their history, were ruled by empires, and they weren't individual countries. And Israel in particular, the last time Israel was a sovereign state was under Jews. In ancient times, before, we're talking about like post-David and Solomon. Israel's never, ever been an independent country except under Jewish sovereignty. It was the British Empire, it was the Ottoman Empire, it was the Roman Empire, but it was never an independent state. The only place that's ever been an independent state is under Jewish sovereignty, which is an amazing thing to think about, actually. So, for what that's worth, but Libya is an artificial creation. Now, artificial creations become, in time, they become natural, and people start to identify themselves as whatever they identify themselves as, which is why, by the way, I shouldn't put this on tape, and this is not what this morning is about, but which is why it's so foolish for Jews to say there are no Palestinians, because people are what they decide they are. It's not actually up to us to decide if someone's a Palestinian or not, it's up to them, just like it's not up to someone else to tell us if we're Jews or not. But we can talk about how deep historically the roots of different people go. And Libya, Jordan, these are not, they're not organic creations, they're the creations of empires. So it's not surprising that the place never quite took off. All right, so chapter 39, Egypt, however, of course, is an ancient nation. And in the ancient Middle East, in the ancient Near East, however you define it, the world was essentially divided between Egypt and Babylonia, Assyria, it changed its name, but between two great powers. And Israel was fought over and under the influence of both throughout its entire history. It was always under Egyptian influence, which is clear if you look at the map, and it was always under Assyrian, Babylonian, Seleucid influence, which is also clear if you look at the map. The only time that that changed was when the Roman Empire took it over, which is a good, from the time we're talking about here, is more than 1,000 years. That's what the Hanukkah story is about, remember, is being under the Assyrians and the Greeks. Okay, so here we are, chapter 39. And Joseph was taken down to Egypt. And a certain Egyptian Potiphar, a courtier of Pharaoh and his chief steward, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him there. Now, I don't want to go back over how he got there. We've talked about that enough. I just want to read the first paragraph and then go over it. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he stayed in the house of his Egyptian master. And when the master saw that the Lord was with him, and the Lord lent success to everything he undertook, he took a liking to Joseph. He made him his personal attendant and put him in charge of his household, placing in his hands all that he owned. And from the time that the Egyptian put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the house for Joseph's sake, so that the blessing of the Lord was upon everything he owned in his house and outside. He left all that he had in Joseph's hands, and with him there he paid attention to nothing save the food that he ate. Now Joseph was well built and handsome. Okay. So, well, what I want to talk about for at least a while today is the sequence of this paragraph, because it's not, the story that it tells is pretty clear, but it's not clear why it tells it in the order that it does. We understand the first part, that Joseph was taken down to Egypt, and also that a certain Egyptian, a courtier of Pharaoh, and his chief steward bought him there from the Ishmaelites. Now, the first thing is, let's say you only had that sentence. There are two sort of complementary things to understand. One is that the chief steward of Pharaoh has his pick of slaves, right? He's the chief steward of Pharaoh. He doesn't get the dregs of the slave market. And remember, there was a slave market, right? All throughout the ancient world. And if you go travel in America today and hit the right sites, they can show you where the markets were. They still dot the South, especially, where the markets were that the slaves were estimated and bought and sold. And people would examine slaves, as you know, the way they examine horses. They look at their teeth and they look at their bodies and make sure that they were sound and all that stuff. So the first thing that you know is that Joseph must be a healthy physical specimen or he wouldn't have bought him. But the other way of looking at this, of course, is theological, which is God wanted to put Joseph in a good house because he could have been buried had he gone into, not literally, but metaphorically buried. In other words, we never would have heard from him again had he gone into a house that was going to be a miserable place. And there is a certain parallel here. Who ends up growing up in the house of a very exalted personage in Egypt? Right, Moses. Moses miraculously gets sold and ends up growing up in Pharaoh's house. Joseph gets sold and ends up in Pharaoh's chief steward's house. And in some ways, by the way, that parallels their position in Jewish history, which is Joseph is high, but he's no Moses, right? Moses gets to grow up in Pharaoh's house. But it also is consistent with the theme of Joseph's life, which is now going to be elaborated. And that is, first of all, there's an ascent and a descent about him. He goes down to the pit, he goes down to jail, and then he rises up in Pharaoh's house. But Joseph is one of those magical personalities. He's sort of touched by angel dust. What he touches eventually turns out right. It may take a while, but it does. And he doesn't ever seem to have any doubt that it'll turn out right, at least none that we're privy to. Because remember, he's sold by his brothers. He travels to Egypt, he's bought by Potiphar, and so far we have not a single word from him. It's all silent. We don't know what's going on in Joseph's mind, right? If he's having a dark night of the soul, we don't hear about it, and it certainly isn't evident in what he says or the way he acts later. So, okay, he bought him there. And then the first thing it tells us is the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man. Now, that's a very generalized statement. It doesn't say, and he did well in Potiphar's house. He's an ish matzliach, a successful man. Now, the reason I was thinking about this actually on the plane back from New York yesterday, because we went to interview rabbinical candidates, and we're going to bring a number of them out, and if you want to see them, they'll be here over the next several weeks. And I thought it's exactly true. You know, we interviewed 14 or 15 candidates. All of them, as you know, people unfold over time, and the first impression that you get from someone is not always the way you feel about them 15 minutes later or a half an hour later or 45 minutes later, which is about how long the interview went. And then, of course, we don't know what they're going to be like in front of a group and so on, which is why you bring them out, because people do change and grow and so on. But there are some people who walk in and you say, since we had only 14 men, no women applied, you say, this is a successful man. Or the opposite, this is not a successful man. And when you get that initial impression, it's not always true, but it pretty much holds. And that's true in every walk of life. You get that sense from someone, and that's what Joseph was, which is why probably Potiphar buys him in the first place, and it's why his subsequent life goes the way it does. And of course, in the ancient world, that was explained by God favoring you. In the modern world, it's explained by Max Weber's term, the sociologist, which is charisma, right? That's what we call it. But in the ancient world, they didn't call it charisma. They called it God being with you. And God was with Joseph, so he was successful. I think that's another way of saying he was charismatic, right? People were drawn to Joseph. You wanted to have him as your slave. But then what's interesting is what it says afterwards. And he stayed in the house of his master, which could have two different implications. One is that maybe the master had a slave house or a carriage house, and that's where he put the shmendriks, you know, the slaves that weren't like top drawer slaves. But the other is that he got to stay there, because you have to assume there was a lot of trading around in the way that, again, on the way back from New York, because always I just, you know, the Torah always fits into your life if you're thinking about teaching it the next day, right? If you're a rabbi, yeah. So I watched the movie, which I'd never seen, Waiting for Superman. I don't know how many of you saw it. It's about the educational system, but the point is that there's one part of it where it talks about how each year in this school district they trade. It's called lemon trading. That is, all the different schools trade off their lousy teachers in the hope that the teachers they'll get will be a little bit less lousy than the teachers they got last year. And And the slave trade was not too dissimilar. That is, slaves that didn't fit in your house, you hoped to get a slave that would be a little bit better, and someone else would take your slave in the hopes that they wouldn't be quite so bad. And so when it says that Joseph stayed in the house of his master, I think it both means that he lived in his house and also that he never wanted to get rid of him, because he was, what's the opposite of a lemon? He was a lime. I don't know what he, I mean, what is not a lemon? He was a successful slave, whatever. He was a sweetener. Yes, exactly, he was a sweetener. Okay, so, when his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord lent success to everything he undertook, he took a liking to Joseph. Again, the sequence is really interesting. First, he sees that God is with him. Then he sees that God makes him successful. So let's translate this now into terms that first he saw that he was charismatic, and second he thought that he actually got things done. Not the same thing, after all, because we all know people who are magnetic, but in the end they don't actually do anything, because they're magnetic and never had to. So Joseph not only was charismatic, but he was a carrier out of things. There is actually a Hebrew word for that, a mivatzeah. I don't know if there's an English one, for someone who actually carries things out. So he was both of those, and when he saw that, he took a liking to him, which is another, actually, this is an interesting and important thing in a way, which is success brings liking, right? And that's what happened to, I mean, he didn't like him until he saw that he was successful, and when he saw that he was successful, he liked him, which is not, you know, I just wrote this review for the Jewish Journal that's going to come out sometime about a biography about Bobby Fischer. Now, Bobby Fischer was crazy, but he was also a genius. We throw that term around a lot. There actually are very few geniuses in the world, but Bobby Fischer was a genius. What's that? He knew how to play chess. I'm talking about at chess. Very few people are a genius at anything. He was like a Mozart of chess. He was really off the charts. He also happened to have had an extraordinarily high IQ when they tested him as a kid. So he was all around brilliant, but he also was a genius at chess. And as a result of it, the people around him took a tremendous amount of abuse at his hands, not because he conferred any benefit on them. He didn't. It's not like he gave them money or he wasn't that kind of person, but just because he was successful, he had the kind of magic that allowed, like with movie stars, people just wanted to be around him. And it's amazing how many people stuck with him despite the fact, until he cut them off, because it was almost always he who cut them off, despite the fact that he was sometimes neglectful and often cruel. But the same sequence happens here, which is he likes Joseph once he sees that Joseph is a success. Then he makes him his personal attendant and put him in charge of his household, placing in his hands all that he owned. So not only does he like him, but he trusts him a lot, right? He puts in his hands all that he owns. So you see that there's like a gradual progression of Joseph's ascent in Potiphar's house. And since you know that one way or another, I mean, we know this now, of course, we've read the story in retrospect, but since you know in one way or another that Joseph is going to get upended, right? The story has that feel. It can't be so simple as he goes to Egypt, he succeeds, and that's it. You know that it has to be something, some betrayal of trust, something that Potiphar doesn't own. Because Joseph, what Potiphar owns, Joseph is going to handle responsibly. But what is it that's going to upend him that Potiphar doesn't own? And of course, we know it's going to be his wife. And from the time that the Egyptian put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed his house for Joseph's sake. So the blessing of the Lord was upon everything he owned in the house and outside. So one of the reasons that Joseph is called Yosef HaTzadik, is Joseph the righteous one, is because every time he opens his mouth, he mentions God. But also the story does that for us. It tells us that Joseph's success is based on God, which lets you know that this is all part of God's plan. Why does God make him so successful in Potiphar's house? Because there's historical patterning to be done. There's work to be done. He has to get everyone down to Egypt. Can't do that if Joseph is not successful. So he left all that he had in Joseph's hands, and with him there, he paid attention to nothing save the food that he ate. Now, I wonder about this. Does that mean that he still had his food tasted, like kings do, and was careful about that? I mean, that's possible. That might mean what it means, or it might just mean that he really paid attention to nothing other than himself. I don't know which thing that's supposed to indicate, but either way, you get the sense that Joseph is he fulfills the same function for Potiphar that he's going to fulfill later for Pharaoh. He's his viceroy. He runs everything. Okay, now Joseph was well built and handsome. No other man in Scripture is described that way. No one else, only Joseph. As a result of this, the rabbis have all sorts of midrashim, all sorts of stories about how vain Joseph was. First of all, because there's a hint of that already in what we've seen about Joseph, right? He's telling everyone about his dreams. He thinks very well of himself. And then you're told that he's well built and handsome, which, I mean, obviously it's an important plot point because Potiphar's wife is about to try to seduce him, but it's a little bit overkill. You don't need to say that in order for her to want to sleep with a young slave. So why is it that we're told that? And also the third aspect of this is you've got to explain why Joseph suffers. You understand why he gets thrown into the pit, because he was insensitive to his brothers, but why does he get thrown in jail for a couple of years after all, which even though it's not described in the Torah, you've got to assume that ancient Egyptian jails are miserable places to be, right? No matter how nice a prisoner you are, why would Joseph deserve that? And the rabbis are always, always looking for a sin that justifies a punishment, right? Midah keneged midah, measure for measure. That's the rabbinic principle. And sometimes it leads them to unreasonable indictments of people, right? Because people get punished, so they cast around for a sin, whether there's one there or not. You see this, by the way, most prominently in the Jewish tradition on Yom Kippur, right? The rabbis basically enumerate every sin you could possibly do because they don't want you to think for a minute that any suffering you've undergone is unjustified. They're much more concerned, you know, it's what Milton said, John Milton, when he wrote Paradise Lost. He said he wrote it to justify the ways of God to man. And that's what the rabbis do. They're trying to justify, I'll tell you why I'm smiling in a second, but they're trying to justify what God does to human beings. There's a poet, Hausmann, who lived a couple hundred years after Milton. Malt means liquor, okay? And he said, malt does more than Milton can to justify the ways of God to man. But the idea that Joseph had to do something wrong or he wouldn't have been punished is very deep in the rabbinic consciousness and I think also very deep in the human, in just the way human beings work. That is, when something goes wrong, we search for an explanation. And by the way, we do that in part to protect ourselves, right? Because if you read the obituary and you found out that the guy smoked, then you're safe. Because I'm not going to die of that because I don't smoke, right? So there is something in believing, because it's easier to feel guilty than to feel helpless, right? If you didn't keep kosher and you got a disease, so now you'll keep kosher and you have some control. So you feel guilty, but you have control. Whereas if your disease isn't dependent on anything you ever did, then you're helpless. And helpless is a lot scarier than guilty. So there's a powerful impulse in human beings and a powerful impulse in the tradition to find out what's the sin that we can name so that we can all avoid it and we won't end up in Egyptian prison. So don't be vain, and you'll be fine. I guess that's more or less the lesson in a way. All right, so this is a long and interesting story, and we won't actually finish all of it now because Nechama Leibovitz has a fascinating analysis that I'm going to bring you next time of the language that is used by everyone, but it's certainly worth at least getting the story. I was going to say under our belts, but then I thought that's really a bad term to use for this. Getting this, being familiar with the story, right, before we, and by the way, we don't have class next week, before I forget, because I'm going to Miami to give a lecture and then to do Rabbi Schuldenfrei's installation at his new congregation. So yeah, which is exactly how I feel about it. It was very nice that he asked me, and I'm very, very happy to do it. But it happens to be Thursday night, because he actually was kind enough to say, I know that it's really hard for you to do it on a weekend. So rather than do it on a weekend, which is when we usually do it, we'll do it during the week. So, all right. Anyway, so we don't have class next week. So in 2 weeks, we'll look over this more carefully. But after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, lie with me, right? Shichva imi. That simple, right? Much more direct than, say, Mrs. Robinson in The Graduate, right? The same idea, but much more direct. Because it's a command, right? She's the master's wife, and she's telling a slave to lie with her. She doesn't have to seduce him. She just has to command him. And here's one of the great touches of the Hebrew Bible. Verse 8, the very first word. Do you see that word? So there are two things I want you to notice about it. First of all, that there's a small line after the word in Hebrew, right? That means there's sort of a stop there. That's like a semicolon, okay? That word means, and he refused. It's all one word, vayima'ein, and he refused. And then you stop for a minute, okay? But look at the note above the word. You see that little squiggly line? That's called a shalshelet. It only appears a handful of times in the Torah. And this is the way you're supposed to sing a shalshelet. You go up and down the scale three times. It's vayima'ein. In other words, wasn't so easy. He didn't just say no, which is an amazing thing that you don't know if you don't know the Hebrew the way that it's sung, right? But it's clearly deliberate, and it's a very rare note. And you can imagine, look, he's a, what, 17, 18-year-old boy, and she's the wife of a rich man in Egypt, and he's a slave, and she commanded him. It's got to be really difficult for him to say no. Now, the traditional rabbinic midrash, which was given an extraordinary, really a twist of genius by Chaim Sabato in Israel, the traditional rabbinic midrash is he saw his father's image before him. That's how he could say no, which is very Freudian, right? The way that people used to explain that is his superego, right? Which is the voice, the conscience voice of your father. Because the rabbis were grappling with how could he have possibly refused, especially, again, in contrast to Judah, who, as we saw last week, even though Judah was a grown man and had, you know, and was a widower, so he obviously wasn't a kid, couldn't refuse when Tamar showed up. So what allows him to refuse? The rabbi said his father's image came before him. So Chaim Sabato, who is a Sephardic rabbi in Israel, who's written novels and writes about the Torah, and is really a wonderful, fascinating man, he was teaching this to the army. He teaches Torah to the army, as you know, a bunch of rabbis, you know, that go through Tzahal and teach Torah. And he said to them, and the rabbis teach us that his father's image came before him. And they laughed at him, like, that's the most ridiculous thing, you know, that he stopped because his father's image came before him. And Sabato came up with this interpretation, which makes a lot of sense. He said, what were the rabbis thinking about? He said, look, in the ancient world, as we've talked about in another context with Jacob and Esau, people never saw themselves. Right. Even if you saw yourself reflected in the water, it doesn't really look like you. And now we see ourselves all the time. We know what we look like. But in the ancient world, nobody really knew what they looked like. Or if they saw themselves once, they didn't see themselves again for years. And so they didn't know what they looked like. He said, where in the ancient world, we know that mirrors existed, but they were very rare because you had to cover them with silver, right? Which was precious. He says, where in the ancient world would you find a mirror? In the bedroom of the wife of the chief steward of Pharaoh. And we're told, in fact, by the Midrash, by the rabbis, that Jacob and Joseph looked like each other. It's one of the reasons why Jacob loved him, remember? So Jacob sees himself maybe for the first time in his life, and he's never seen himself before. So who does he look like? the only face he has seen, which is his father. And when he, Joseph's, yeah, sorry. So when he looks in the mirror, when she says, lie with me on her bed, below which is the mirror, the first one he's ever seen, and he looks at himself, he all of a sudden sees his father and he can't do it. Isn't that brilliant? Yeah. I love that. God, I love that. So, yeah. What's that? Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, that's it's a little risky, I confess. Right. When you're about to go to bed with someone, just think of me. Yeah. So can you imagine that? Yeah. But the key here is not whether Sabato is right or not right. The key is that there was something in Joseph's character, and this is the first time that we've seen it. We've seen Joseph be gifted. We've seen him be arrogant. We've seen him be loved. We've never seen him be strong. This required tremendous strength of character, after all. Look, we don't know how he acted when he was sold into Egypt. Maybe he was strong, maybe he was weak. All we know is he was quiet, but he could be quiet to preserve himself, just like he could be quiet because he was just strong. But now Joseph is completely different in our eyes because he has to know that refusing her is not going to, in the end, turn out good. Now, neither way probably would turn out well, right? Whether he refused or he didn't refuse her, it wasn't going to turn out well. But, you know, Shakespeare may have invented the words, but the idea of hell hath no fury like a woman scorned was not a new thought in Shakespeare's time. And Joseph wasn't an idiot. He had to know that if she says, lie with me, and he, a slave, says no to the wife of his master, that it's not going to be pretty. And yet he does. Even though he hesitates, he does. So now Joseph's story takes a very different turn. Let's just read a little bit more before we... He refused. And why does he refuse? What's the reason he gives her? He says, look with me here, right? My master gives no thought to anything in his house, and all that he owns he's placed in my hands. He wields no more authority in the house than I, and he's withheld nothing from me except yourself, since you are his wife, in case you forgot. How then could I do this most wicked thing and sin before God? Now, remember again, these are the first words that we've heard Joseph speak since his father sent him from his house to check on his brothers. Right? Since he asked the guy from Dothan, the Ish Dothan, where are my brothers? We've heard him say nothing but nothing but nothing. These are the first words he speaks, and the first time he speaks, he mentions God, as he will subsequently over and over again. Not only that, but as we'll talk about in more detail when we analyze all the language in a couple weeks, he first says to her, he reminds her that he has some authority in the house. He's not a simple slave. Right? Because he doesn't want her to think, you can just order me around like any other slave. There's actually some risk here. Because not only am I a slave, but I'm a slave that your husband has entrusted everything to, and the success of the house is due at least in large part to my efforts. So it's not just that you're going to get rid of me, but you're also going to hurt the economic interests of the house, and he's given me everything except for you. Since, after all, you're his wife. So it is strategic. He doesn't just say, I can't do it because it's bad, right? But then he says, how could I do this wicked thing and sin before God? And why does he divide those two up? Why doesn't he just say sin before God? Because maybe she has no conception of God, but there was never a society in history that didn't have a conception of good things to do and bad things to do. Right? So he's putting it in both terms, whether you want to think of this as just bad according to Egyptian morals or a sin before God, either way, I can't do it. So he really does try in a short compass, because it's a fairly brief speech, although for the Bible it's actually a long speech, but it's a fairly brief speech. He tries to put every possible reason before her to leave him alone, right? And what he doesn't say, of course, because Joseph is not foolish, is I don't want you. And by the way, that seems not to be the case, or you wouldn't have that note over Vayimaen, right? Because if he didn't want her, he would have refused her much more easily, although still the command from the wife of a chief steward would be tough to just say no to. But he doesn't say that to her, nor does he say, I would love to, but. He just says, I can't do it, and this is why I can't do it. He leaves the question of desire or her desirability completely out of it. And he's successful in this, in that he doesn't entirely turn her off. In other words, it says, you'll notice it says, much as she coaxed Joseph day after day, he didn't yield to her request to lie beside her, to be with her. Now, you could say, I mean, actually, you could. I suppose you could interpret this two ways, and maybe after this we'll take comments and questions. You could say that this shows that he wasn't definitive enough. But you could also say that had he been too definitive, he would have insulted her beyond. So if he said to her, look, I can't do it, I wish I could, but I can't do it. In other words, he left the door open enough so that she didn't feel too rejected. But then she pursues him over and over again. So it's very tricky. It is very tricky. I'm just thinking about the fact that in sexual politics, especially, usually in the reverse, right? Usually women with men, there's a very powerful impulse to refuse openly. I mean, to refuse rather, but leave the door slightly open so the person won't feel, so you won't crush that ego, but you still can say no, right? If you say, are you kidding? I would never be interested in you. Then you have, how do I put this delicately? Then you have made impossible any advantage you could ever derive from that relationship, right? But if you say, if you close the door in a way that still feels the other person, that still makes the other person feel desirable, but for whatever reason, this is impossible, then you haven't closed that door. And it's very possible that Joseph was thinking, look, I don't want her to think that I never want her because she's the wife of the chief, and I might need her at some point. So the one thing that I do have over her is that she desires me. Therefore, I don't want to crush that, because that's my card in this exchange, which is true. And after all, he's a slave and he has to play the cards that he has. So I don't want to crush that in her, and yet I don't want to yield to it. The downside of that, of course, is that if it's a persistent person, as Potiphar's wife was, she'll take him at his word, which is, it's only for circumstantial reasons that you refuse me, so I'll keep at it. And that in the end, I mean, and in the end, if circumstances continue, then either the person is going to give up, or if they can and are vengeful, as she was, take revenge, which is exactly what she does in the scene that we're going to come to next time, which is when, you know, she claims that he assaulted her, when of course he didn't. Okay, so let's stop there for a minute and take comments and questions. Yeah, Angela.
Why isn't Potiphar's wife given
a name? It's a good question. Why isn't Potiphar's wife given a name? So, I don't think he gives a reason. She remains nameless throughout the story. Her designation serves a dual purpose. It draws attention to Joseph's dilemma in antagonizing someone so powerful, because that's who she is after all. She's Potiphar's wife. And it emphasizes the inherent irony of the situation. She, the mistress of the house, is a slave to her lust for her husband's slave. That's at least Sarna's explanation of it. So that's why, because she's not a person in her own right. She's also a plot mechanism in a way, but I'm guessing that that's why. I don't know. Or, I mean, the ungenerous interpretation is, why do you need to give her a name? She's only a wife, right? And in the ancient world, that's, I'm saying that, you know, if you think that the Bible is being misogynist here, that's the interpretation, is that she doesn't need a name. I don't know. Yes?
I pick up on the part of the verse that says, pay attention to nothing save the food he ate.
Yeah. It's Henry VIII in later years. Yeah. You know, he started out as a young, handsome man, Henry VIII. But in later years, he was gross in every sense of that word. I mean, he was immense, immense, immense. It is possible that that's what that phrase is meant to convey, that she has to live with this unappealing guy So when an attractive slave comes into the house, she naturally goes after him, and she lives with somebody who is manipulable, since she does manipulate her husband. So, yeah.
But tagging on to that is, he doesn't pay attention to anything. So maybe he doesn't pay attention to her, and she doesn't, none of her desires are met, and, you know, he's ignoring her.
And yeah, so this is...
He's just not paying attention to everything else, you know, that he owns, but he's not paying attention to his wife.
You could build a really good case, it's true, from those two facts about Potiphar's neglect of her or inability to be a husband to her. And it may be, you know, one of the interesting things about the Bible and one of the interesting things about good stories in general is that you can turn them upside down. So let's say you wanted to turn this story upside down. What you have is... a gross, unappealing man who basically reneges all of his responsibility to his household to this slave, doesn't pay attention to his wife, and his wife in desperation reaches out to this slave who is moralistic and prissy and won't sleep with her. You could, right? You could write the story that way. You absolutely could. One of the things that all of us know is that unappealing characters can be made very appealing, and vice versa. I can't remember the name of the movie. I think the movie was A Date, but Bernardo Bertolucci made this movie where at the very beginning you see Donald Sutherland being pursued by all these peasants with a rake that are obviously intent on killing him, and you feel like tremendous compassion and fear for this guy who's being run after by all these. And then by the end of the movie, he's such a villain throughout the movie. By the end of the movie, you're rooting for the peasants to get him, right? And Bertolucci is making the point, I'm sure he made, I saw this years ago, I don't remember anything else about the movie. I saw it a long time ago, but I remember thinking a good storyteller can make you like or hate anyone they want. And you could easily turn this story on its head and make you like Potiphar's wife and hate Joseph. You could, right? But it's kind of neat to see it as, and I'll have to look, which I have not done. You know, I have a couple of women's commentaries to the Bible. It'll be interesting to see, and I'll look for next time, how they treat Potiphar's wife. Yeah?
It was interesting that last week your comment about how, in your experience, men are sought after because they can make a good living and mm-hmm. support people and they're successful. And women
right.
are there because they're beautiful. And then you come to the next chapter, and it's the reverse, where she's...
Right. Exactly so. Because that's great.
He gets screwed by not getting screwed.
I want to make sure that the tape picked that up, right? He gets screwed by not getting screwed. So, it's a wonderful point that it's exactly the reverse. Here, it's the man who's pursued for his beauty and the woman who has the power and the influence, which just tells you that, of course, all generalizations are false. It doesn't matter how true they are. There, you can always find a very powerful counterexample, and you can find lots of counterexamples in the world. And so it's never right. It is never so simple as the generalization. But I do wonder what larger point, and maybe that's part of it. What larger point the Bible is making about human nature? And I would say that at least part of it is that. There are different forms of power. There are different forms of power, and they get wielded differently. And beauty is a power, and wealth is a power, and political power is a power, and, you know, parenthood is a power over children, and children's hold on their parents' emotions is a form of power. And we don't like to analyze human relationships in terms of power, but you could, you know. So it's what the French say. In every relationship, there is someone who kisses and someone who offers the cheek. And that means that the power relationship is almost never equal in any relationship. And that certainly is true here. They both have a form of power, but ultimately, hers is greater, because public power can crush private power. right? That's, again, to return to the story of Henry VIII, right? Because ultimately, he was the more powerful than his wives because he had public power, and they didn't. So, yeah.
Why do you hear over and over again he's Egyptian? The Egyptian house, the Egyptian master. It says at least three times.
Yeah, I know. I'm assuming that it's sort of foreshadowing of how important Egypt is going to be in the story, although I don't know for sure. I don't know. But I noticed that, too, that it mentions Egyptian over and over again. I don't know. Yeah.
Ten Commandments comes afterward at the time of Moses, right?
Yes.
People knew the strength of each commandment, like don't do adultery.
Well, we already know about adultery, and it's because don't forget, Abraham is worried about adultery with Sarah. That's why he says his wife is his sister. And then remember that Abimelech says, why did you do this to me and almost make me sin by sleeping with your wife? So he knew.
So, yes,
I think adultery, there are two schools of thought in the Jewish tradition about the commandments. Right. One is that not every commandment was given. The commandments weren't given till they were given. The other is that the patriarchs observed all the commandments before they were given. But apart from that, I think that in all the ancient world, there were certain sort of universal prohibitions. Murder was a prohibition everywhere at all times. Right. It doesn't mean that it wasn't always violated, but it was a prohibition. And adultery was. For all the reasons that you would think, I mean, among other things, adultery was a property crime. Because if you don't know whose the kid is, let's say Mr. and Mrs. Jones are married, and Mr. Jones has a big estate, and Mrs. Jones has a kid with Mr. Smith. Then Mr. Jones's estate is going to go to Smith's kid, but Jones doesn't know it. And that's why in the Ten Commandments, what it prohibits is a woman who's married sleeping with another man. It doesn't prohibit a man who's married because he keeps his estate intact, right? Now, the rabbis prohibit it, but that's not what's originally in the Ten Commandments. And the reason is that the attempt to keep the estate together, and also because, remember, in the ancient world, if a married man sleeps with a woman, so he marries her. So you got two wives or three wives or four wives, which certainly isn't against the Ten Commandments, though it's against later Jewish law. Whereas a woman can only marry one man, so if she sleeps with another man, it's violating the Ten Commandments. Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4.
So Judah sinned when he slept with Tamar, or because he was a widow?
Well, he was a widow. So, I mean, I suppose in some way, I mean, sleeping with someone you think is a prostitute would be considered a sin by the rabbis, it certainly was, but it wasn't adultery. It was sort of quasi-incest, but he didn't know that. Yeah.
This is a good story for later in Jewish history, because all the kings or high people who employed Jews, if you look at this story, they feel reassured.
Yes. This one is a good one. That's true, because Joseph actually doesn't violate. You know, if you're looking at the Bible, which a lot of people did throughout history to try to judge how the Jews would behave, this is one of the ones where we come out well, although also the whole Joseph story has bad parts too, because his brothers sell him into slavery. But yes, in terms of, and later court Jews, and there were such a thing throughout the Middle Ages, court Jews, that is Jews who served, they always looked back to the Joseph story as a sort of paradigm, like Furtwängler's novel, Jude Suisse, became anti-Semitic stereotype, but it was a famous novel in its time. Anyway, yeah. You see a relationship between Tamar and Potiphar's wife. I suppose that's true. It's hard to get away when you deal with human beings. It's hard to get away from sexual politics. Right. Yes. And the part of the lesson, I think, of the continual fractured families that you find in the Bible is, in fact, that life is much messier than we generally publicly acknowledge. And that's just true over and over and over and over again. And there's, I suppose, it's, and the balance that the Torah strikes is acknowledging it without condoning it, which is a tough balance, because to understand is to forgive, as the old proverb goes, but it's not, here it tries to acknowledge it without saying it's okay. It's clear that it thinks what Potiphar's wife did is not okay. And what Tamar did is very edgy, because Judah doesn't say, remember, and I didn't make this point last time, Judah does not say to her, you were right and I was wrong. He says, you were more right than I, which means she was a little wrong too, because even though she had no other recourse, to dress up as a prostitute and seduce your father-in-law is not really what the Torah wants most people to do. So that's why he says, Tzidkami meni, you were more right than I was, but he doesn't say, you're right and I was wrong. And that's a really, in some ways, it's a beautiful line that the Torah walks. That is, we understand human beings are flawed creatures. Their lives are going to be messy, and things are not going to go the way they're supposed to, but that doesn't mean that you should abandon the standard just because that's inevitably going to happen. What you have to do is know that you will sin, but not call it not a sin, which is, I think, you know, it's the best we get in this world. Right.
And all of a sudden, he's a man with a lot of difficult values.
Yes.
So, how do you explain?
Well, there are lots of different ways of imagining Joseph's trajectory from being in his father's house to now. Here's another way of thinking about it. I mean, I don't explain it any single way, but here's another way of thinking about it. Let's say Joseph is, among his other attributes, what we have already seen, which is very egotistical. Let's say an egotistical, handsome man is told by a woman so peremptorily, sleep with me. And he says, no. You could imagine it, right? Maybe this is not a function only of Joseph's morality, but also of his ego. I don't want to sleep with you just because you told me to sleep with you. So you can imagine it that way. It's not that he's unethical in his father's house. He doesn't do anything unethical. He does things that are unwise and vain and egotistical, but he's not unethical. But the other thing is that again and again and again, not only in the Torah, but in rabbinic literature and especially in Hasidic literature. This is like one of the top themes of Hasidic literature, is that you only grow through brokenness. That you have to be broken to grow. And you got to imagine, however strong Joseph is, to be thrown into a pit by his brothers, because they're still his brothers, to be threatened with death, to be sold into slavery, to travel across the desert not knowing what his fate is going to be, to get brought to this house. There has to be some brokenness in that. And I can't imagine that he could come out the same person that he went in. Who among us would? So maybe that's what did it to him. Yeah, Miriam. Fine, I can't hear you. Yes. He doesn't, in other words, he thinks this is the less dangerous option, is not sleeping with her, because he's afraid if he sleeps with her, he loses everything. It may also be that he thinks, okay, if I don't sleep with her, maybe he'll kick me out of the house, but if I sleep with her, he may kill me. Right. It is true that it could be the more dangerous option is to sleep with her, because, I mean, I presume that Potiphar could kill him for nothing if he felt like it, but he found out he slept with his wife, that would be a powerful enough motivation. Yeah. Right. Yes.
Also, he was really attached to his father, and Potiphar had given him all this
So he might think of him.
And he says he sees his father face, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden
right.
it's like his father and his mother or something, and then it's like he's feeling really trespassed in who he's trying
right.
to reestablish himself to be as an identity.
We are not, yes, we're not unfamiliar in the Bible with substitute fathers. Saul, remember, he's a bad substitute father for David, but he's a substitute father for David. So it is possible, right, that he identifies Potiphar with his father. His father took care of him at home. Potiphar takes care of him at his new home. And to betray him is in some sense betraying his father, which could be another spring of the rabbi's midrash. Why do they say he saw the face of his father? Because Potiphar took his father's place. Did you say writers plural? Erwin. Yeah.
And then they're gone.
Yes. Well, I mean, one of the characteristics of a great story or a novel is that the minor characters come vividly to life too, but it doesn't mean they have to hang around the whole time. So you can get very... I was talking with someone the other day about Les Mis. Remember the innkeeper, master of the house? He has that one song. He becomes an incredibly vivid character, but the story's not really about him. But that's the point is that a great artist lavishes care on every character that he or she creates. He or she with a capital H or S in this case. And so you're right. There are lots and lots and lots of minor characters in the Bible, and some of them unnamed, like the man from Dothan or like Potiphar's wife, but they play an essential role in moving along the story of the major characters, like Joseph. So, last question. Yeah.
Is it just too naive to think or to say that maybe Jacob had the sense of ethical behavior before he was given the Torah after all, and they say over and over, God is with him?
Right. Right. It's in fact not naive at all, and it's the most probable, most mainstream answer is that Joseph believed in God and thought that God, I mean, look, the essential message of the Torah, if you had to boil it down into a sentence, is human beings are in the image of God and therefore have to behave a certain way in this world because that's what God wants of us. And so Joseph's behavior here is a perfect illustration of exactly what it is that, and don't forget that he's supposed to be representing Jewish values in a pagan society, right? Maybe Egyptians act like this, you can almost hear him saying, but I'm an Israelite and we don't behave this way. Now, that doesn't mean that no Israelite ever behaves that way in the Torah, but you clearly get that general implication because I just want to close with this. The rabbis said this more than once. They said, what was it about idolatry that was so terrible? Why does the Torah always preach against idolatry? And one of their answers that's repeated more than once is that idolatry gave license to people in a way that ethical monotheism doesn't. In other words, they said, because pagans have no sexual boundaries at all. You know, they had cult prostitutes and so on. And the rabbis looked at that and said, look at how pagans behave. It's not what they worship, but it's what their worship does to their conduct that makes this so awful. And that's why we're different. And the Joseph story was a beautiful illustration of that. Okay, see you in 2 weeks. Let's stand up and do the Kaddish de Rabbanan.